and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the additional sanctions placed on North Korea following Trump's threat before the UN to, quote, totally destroy the country. Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University who specializes in Korea and its neighbors in Northeast Asia, China, Russia, and Japan, and is the editor of the ASEAN Forum, joins us. We will discuss whether Trump's order to ban ships and planes that have visited North Korea from entering the U.S. for 180 days will have any effect, and whether Trump's praise for President Xi and China's central bank that, quote, their central bank has told their other banks, and that's a massive banking system, to immediately stop doing business with North Korea, is based on reality or wishful thinking, since this is a claim that Chinese authorities have yet to confirm. Then we'll assess the likelihood that Puerto Rico will get the aid it urgently needs following the devastation from Hurricane Maria, which has left the island without water and electricity, with the governor estimating that it will take a month or more to get electricity back for the whole island. Charles Venator Santiago, professor of Latino politics and professor of political science at the Institute of Puerto Rican and Latino Studies at the University of Connecticut, joins us to discuss how Puerto Rico's fate is in the hands of the Republican Congress following a 2016 federal law establishing PROMESA, the Puerto Rico Oversight, Management, and Economic Stability Act, which has imposed austerity to deal with an extended debt and bankruptcy crisis. Then finally, as the special counsel Robert Mueller zeroes in on Paul Manafort, we will investigate whether Trump's former campaign manager was a Kremlin asset and an important part of an overall Russian intelligence operation to manipulate the American election to hurt Hillary Clinton and help Donald Trump. Anders Asland, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University and a former Swedish diplomat in Moscow who was an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine, joins us to discuss the ties between Manafort, the deposed pro-Russian Ukrainian leader Yanukovych, and Russian and Ukrainian oligarchs close to Putin. And joining us now is Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia. The editor of the ASEAN Forum, he is the author of International Relations and Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations, and North Korea and Mongolia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gilbert Rosman.
Happy to join you.
Well, thank you, Gilbert. And President Trump announced that he's ramping up sanctions on North Korea and targeting foreign companies and individuals that do business with North Korea in Northeast Asia, which is the area that you specialize in. Apparently, Chinese President Xi Jinping has ordered Chinese banks to cease conducting business with North Korean entities, and Donald Trump called that move very bold and somewhat unexpected in praising Xi. So how does this gel with the commonly held belief that the one thing the Chinese don't want is an economic collapse in North Korea, and two, they don't want the country to fall into a failed state and collapse and have the U.S. Army on the Yalu River? So at this point, how are they finessing this, and how does this new round of sanctions fit into that broader picture?
You're right to refer to this as a new round because we've had so many and even recent rounds. They're coming one after another. And each time we're ratcheting up the pressure on North Korea, and China is saying it will join. Now, China has not implemented these sanctions as fully as expected frequently. For instance, some thought that the real turning point, the point that would be the biggest test, was the beginning of 2016 when China agreed to tougher sanctions, and we would then have North Korea under considerably more pressure. And when the trade statistics came out for 2016, China's trade with North Korea went up quite a bit. So they may sanction one area, but they often find a way to do something else, to work with North Korea. And of course, much of what they provide North Korea is not trade. It's more in the form of assistance. So I would say that this is a very positive step. It's really what we've been, it's the trajectory the U.S. has been on for quite a while now, years. If North Korea does something further, we have a somewhat of an understanding with China. We will up the pressure on North Korea, and China will go along to a degree. But at each step, it is tough. China only partially agrees. Even Russia is right now even more reticent than China to agree. And then in the case of the big banks, China is closing the big banks trading with North Korea, but there are some credit facilities, there are some smaller banks that aren't really involved in the international financial system that some expect will continue to have financial dealings with North Korea. Nonetheless, it's a significant upgrading of pressure, which many welcome.
So is this to say that the Chinese are cooperating with the U.S. in sanctions? Because one of the things that the White House is saying is that this executive order of Trump's imposes a ban on ships and planes that visit North Korea. They'll be banned for 180 days from visiting the United States. Now, we know that the U.S. has long wanted to board North Korean ships and interdict their smuggling and counterfeiting $100 bills and all of the activities, drug and methamphetamines and heroin, etc., that the regime traffics in order to make hard currency. The U.S. has always wanted to go after that. So on the one hand, it looks as if China may be to some extent cooperating with that effort, but at the same time maintaining what essentially amounts to foreign aid, humanitarian aid. Is that how the picture looks?
Well, China is offering more than humanitarian aid. The traffic has continued to be pretty heavy across the Dandong Bridge, which was the lifeline for the North Korean economy from China. There's also an oil pipeline that's operating, and China agreed to some cutbacks, but most of its oil supply to North Korea will continue. Russia has a small ship that used to ply between Japan and North Korea, and now is going between Vladivostok and North Korea, and it's just increased its activity. There was just an announcement at the Eastern Economic Forum where President Putin was in Vladivostok about boosting trade, and trade has gone up quite a bit with North Korea in the last year, although it's far lower than that of China. So if the U.S. wants to cut, not allow ships that go to North Korea to come to the United States, that won't be very meaningful because these tend to be local ships and local means of transportation that are fueling the North Korean economy.
So the president met with the South Korean leader today at the United Nations. And of course, it's pretty extraordinary, the cavalier way that when Trump said that he would totally destroy North Korea in front of the UN, which is, I don't think anybody's ever threatened a member state in that way. Mm-hmm. Maybe Khrushchev banging his shoe or whatever, but it was a pretty extraordinary thing. Now, what seems counterintuitive or even blasé on the part of the U.S. when they talk about military options, they forget that 10 to 20 million South Koreans are the collateral damage of any major war. And on top of that, the U.S. has been threatening to pull out of the South Korea-U.S. trade deal that Obama negotiated. So I don't know the extent to which things were repaired. The meeting in Vladivostok, by the way, the South Korean leader went there, did he not, to show the Americans that he has other options?
Well, he did go on that last point. I'm not sure he went there to show other options. The South Korean leaders, for the last 10 years or so, have been trying to have good relations with Russia because they want Russia to help them put pressure on North Korea, and because they see that Russia's moving in the opposite direction. So they keep trying to encourage Russia to think about the future of a united Korea, or Korea which no longer has this terrible conflict, where pipelines and trains can go straight down from the Pacific coast all the way through the Korean Peninsula from Russia. So this is just one more step where the Koreans have been encouraging the Russians, and Moon Jae-in did a particularly active job of urging Putin to do more and giving him hope that this would be a positive thing. But basically, Russia has lined up too much pro-North Korea and too critical of what South Korea is doing. For instance, the THAAD missile defense system, Russia has accused South Korea of putting in an effort to change the military balance with Russia along with the United States, and they have been very critical of South Korea. So I don't think that Moon Jae-in really has an alternative to working closely with the United States, however much he objects to the language Trump uses as not helpful in trying to move this relationship forward.
Well, at the meeting today at the UN with Trump and the Japanese leader and South Korean President Moon Jae-in, Moon praised Trump's speech, saying that North Korea has continued to make provocations and this is extremely deplorable. And by the way, when he used the word deplorable, Trump sort of flinched because that has echoes of Hillary Clinton. And this has angered both me and our people, but the U.S. has responded firmly and in a very good way. So that's about the only praise I've heard for Trump's speech before the U.N. Most people have found it appalling.
Well, Abe, speaking at the UN a day later, before he, after he was in Russia, was the one who openly at the UN spoke positively about Trump's speech. The basic situation is, however much they're nervous about a military action that can lead to a wider war, there is a mood of solidarity right now with the increasing pressure on North Korea, trying to get China to do more, making it seem as if there are other options if China doesn't put more pressure on North Korea. They prefer sanctions, they prefer talks, but they at the same time they don't think without this kind of whiff of possible military action, which could take many forms, such as shooting down North Korean missiles that are flying over Japan or flying towards Guam, that this kind of whiff of action doesn't serve a process that could lead to negotiations.
So, by the way, Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu also praised the speech. So it wasn't without praise, but I think the general consensus was that it was pretty shocking. But let's go back to the idea that, well, let me ask you this question. Is the Kim regime in North Korea more afraid of the Chinese than the Americans? In other words, he's already murdered his uncle, who was close to the Chinese. He murdered his older half-brother, who the Chinese could have perhaps installed if they are in a position to engineer some kind of coup. So what is that relationship like?
It has been a particularly cold relationship the last 5 years. Xi Jinping has not met with Kim Jong-un, and he's met several times with the leaders of South Korea. So there is this feeling that Xi is angry with the North Koreans. He wants to put more pressure on them. But the idea that North Korea is somehow more afraid of China in the short term, I'm not talking about 10 years or 20 years down the line when they may be trying to preserve their independence, their sovereignty in an area where China is more and more influential and powerful. But if you're talking about the short term, China shows no inclination of thinking about military action. China talks about dialogue, coming back to six-party talks without preconditions, such as a commitment to denuclearize. Those are terms that are favorable to North Korea. The United States says the situation is intolerable. We might take military action. So clearly, right now, North Korea is more afraid of the United States.
So there's no possibility or capability on the part of the Chinese to engineer some coup in North Korea?
Well, I don't know a great deal about the internal political workings of North Korea, and I imagine very few people do. There's no sign of dissidents. There's no sign of factions in the leadership. There's no sign in the public eye that the Chinese have real leverage there. The Chinese have been squeezed out of some of the contacts they just had a few years ago. So I can't see that happening.
Well, it's such an impasse. One's trying to kind of flay about here to try and figure out how you could bring about some kind of peace. Now, one of the suggestions I've had with other Korean analysts is, why doesn't the U.S. just slap down a peace treaty on the table in Panmunjom and surprise the North Koreans and do what Gorbachev said when he ended the Cold War with the United States, saying, we're not going to be your enemy anymore? Is that a chimeric and
Let's see what we could do that the North Koreans might accept.
Right.
Are we going to withdraw our troops from South Korea? Are we going to take away our protective nuclear umbrella and other protection from South Korea? Are we going to say that North Korea and South Korea should work together to unify the country in their own manner, which North Korea would use as a way to try to pressure South Korea to give up much of what it has? So, I mean, that is rather facile to suggest that somehow a peace treaty is what they want. They're after something much bigger here, as far as many people suggest, and a peace treaty would not change their nuclear potential and nuclear blackmail. And we did come up with not treaties, but agreements with North Korea several times in the past 25 years. And the most promising, I thought, was 2007, and they collapsed in 2008, and then Obama was greeted with a much more belligerent North Korea. And I think he tried for many years to figure out a way to restart negotiations and to offer North Korea some of the basic things it seemed to be seeking. But I don't think North Korea would find those things satisfactory at all. It's a regime that fears what would happen should there be a peace process and it has to open up. South Korea is prosperous. The people of North Korea don't know what, unless they get some outside information these days, don't know what's really going on in the world, and they're supposed to treat their leadership like a god. If they found out the truth, the North Korean leadership and the regime might collapse. And so I think their goal is not to have peaceful integration and rejoin the international community, but to be able to continue on their own terms with continued ability to pressure and use nuclear weapons to get what they want from other countries.
Well, I brought up that rather fanciful notion of a peace treaty simply because the hostility to the United States is the glue that holds that regime together, and the people have been brainwashed from cradle to grave. And by the way, they have, memories of being totally destroyed in the Korean War by the U.S.
Yep,
Air Force.
Yes, they do.
So they're not without any substance here in terms of their paranoia. But that's the frightening thing. I don't know whether you've read the piece by Evan Osnos in The New Yorker, but it's shocking how ubiquitous the brainwashing is, and that these people would die for their emperor, for their dear leader, or whatever he calls himself, Kim Jong-un. I mean, the story about the visiting the school where they showed off pictures of Kim's visit, from 1,000 pictures of him walking down the corridor to the fact that he touched a kid's blanket and now that blanket's enshrined in a glass case like some religious icon. It's just mind-boggling, isn't it? How
And it's been the way we've been learning about this country for the last 60 years, that one leader after another has a similar godlike cult. Mm-hmm. That's the way they've created their country, and they don't want anyone to interrupt what they're doing.
They don't, but you was just saying, if the people knew how the other Koreans in the South were living, and I believe that some videotapes of South Korean soap operas are smuggled in.
Yes.
I don't know whether there's any way that you can send balloons or leaflets or something to get the North Korean people to realize what a bad deal they have while this...
Yeah, well, that's one of the strategies that's been tried. It's not easy. There are groups that are sending the balloons. There are a lot of DVRs, but the crackdown on the border has intensified. The penalties are harder. But then North Korea also has opened up markets more, allowing more independent entrepreneurship at the local level, giving its people a little bit more opportunity to live separately from state domination.
Well, just in closing, though, Gilbert Rosman, the thing that worries the analysts that I talk to is that with this bellicose threats, from Donald Trump and from Kim Jong-un, who, the North Koreans have perfected that kind of hyperbole, that we could stumble into a nuclear war. So What's your sense of how fragile this situation is? It certainly seems to have the Chinese worried. It has the Russians worried. It even has Angela Merkel concerned and other Western allies of the United States.
Well, I think this has been something that was on the horizon for many years, that the showdown between the United States and North Korea was not unexpected, and it was intensified as North Korea moved with surprising rapidity on its missiles and its increasingly strong nuclear weapons. So, yes, I think this is a real danger. Trump's language has shifted some of the perceptions about this in an unfortunate way, because he's not seen as a statesman. He's not seen as rallying others together with the diplomacy that's required. But the basic dynamics are Japan, South Korea, and the United States deciding that more pressure is needed, and China and Russia going along to a degree. But I think most anticipate that at some point North Korea will say, okay, we're ready to talk. And that'll prove even more difficult for many, because the goals of the countries in these negotiations will be very much in conflict. What some countries want from these talks will be very different. And in the meantime, the United States may have some kind of red line about an ICBM that can reach the United States. And the question right now is, should the United States have that red line or not? And if we do have that red line and it's justified, what kind of action should the U.S. be taking to try to make sure that line isn't crossed? And so that's the way I would put this issue.
And that, of course, brings us back to ground zero, in effect, because on the one hand, Trump says bellicose things, and his aide, Stephen Bannon, says there's nothing we can do. They've got the South Koreans in Seoul hostage. They've got us. So yep. I don't see the military option ever working. But as you say, the more the red line becomes apparent and that missiles can strike American cities, the more pressure there will be, I imagine, to come up with a nuclear option. And apparently Trump asks the military guys every day, Madison Company, you know, what are the military options? And they keep saying there are none. So I don't know.
Well, Mattis just said publicly there are some. I don't know if he did that.
He did, and he wouldn't say what they were.
No, he wouldn't.
And I wonder whether that's just talk or whether there's some Buck Rogers weapon system that we don't know about.
Well, we all wonder that.
Okay. Well, thanks for joining us. I'm glad that you filled us in on some of this perplexing puzzle in that area of North Asia where China, North Korea, and Russia meet.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Gilbert Rosman, a professor of sociology at Princeton University, specializing in societies of China, Japan, Korea, and Russia. He's the editor of the ASEAN Forum and the author of International Relations and Asia's Northern Tier, Sino-Russian Relations, and North Korea and Mongolia. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back assessing the likelihood that Puerto Rico will get the aid it urgently needs following the devastation from Hurricane Maria.
Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration. When human respect is disintegrating, this whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Keeps on raining, that is gonna break. If it keeps on raining, that is going to break.
When the levee breaks, have no place to stay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Charles Venator Santiago, who's a professor of Latino politics, public law, and political theory, who holds a joint appointment with the Department of Political Science and the Institute of Puerto Rican and Latin American Studies at the University of Connecticut. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Venator Santiago.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Charles. And let me begin with you and your family in Puerto Rico. How are they faring in the aftermath of this tremendous hurricane?
So I haven't been able to speak to half of my relatives, particularly my aunts. They're out of communication. My mother's apartment, a fourth-floor apartment in a condominium, was flooded, and she's really scared and anxious. So I'm actually traveling this weekend to pick her up and bring her to the United States until electricity is restored or there's a little semblance of normalcy in the island. But things are very difficult. Transportation is difficult, and there's no access to basic necessities yet.
And the governor, Ricardo Rossello, predicted a long period of recovery. The infrastructure has been, obviously has not had sufficient investment for some time, but the electrical infrastructure is down. It may take up to a month. That in itself is pretty shocking, isn't it, that we all depend so much on electricity.
So electricity and water off. In terms of the electric grid, it's been down, it's been on and off for about a year now. And they haven't had the resources to invest or create a new grid. So part of what's going on is that air gave it a jolt and knocked it down, and now this Maria, Hurricane Maria, that basically devastated the cables on top of putting pressure on the electric grid. So part of the problem is there's a lot of down cables and now a lot of down electric poles. So they're talking anywhere from 1 month to 3 months or maybe more without electricity.
So if there hasn't been sufficient investment in the electric grid over the years, where would this influx of investment money needed to just patch up the situation now, temporary measure even, as opposed to do the much-needed investment that has been postponed?
So there are three problems going on. First is that because Puerto Rico is an unincorporated territory, Congress has the power to discriminate in terms of how much infrastructure investment is willing to finance in the island, or how much investment or funding is extended to Puerto Rico. So once this is all, once Puerto Rico is sort of moving after out of this situation, it's going to have to assume responsibility over developing a new grid. And given the financial crisis, it just doesn't have the funding. The second is really around the question of FEMA, whether the FEMA money or the debt or the hurricane relief money that's coming from the federal government will incorporate the possibility of building a new grid and update it, more modern grid. And given the experience of New Jersey, it's not clear that Republicans are going to support the idea of not just fixing what's broken, but also using additional money to address the infrastructure problems that Puerto Rico cannot resolve. The third point that's really important to emphasize is that when Congress passed the PROMESA law, the fiscal responsibility law, last summer, within the first two paragraphs, it stated that it was unwilling to assume full faith and credit over the debt of Puerto Rico or the island's finances. So that suggests that unless Congress is willing to negotiate with the Financial Review Board or Control Board, there's no money coming to address these issues. So the push has been to privatize the electric company as a way to get external investors to essentially build a new grid, a more modern grid that can the challenges of island living.
Well, at least President Trump seems to be aware of it. He said today, their electric grid is destroyed. It wasn't in good shape to start off with, but their electrical grid is totally destroyed and so many other things. We're going to start with very great gusto, he said, but it's very, very, very perilous shape. Very sad what happened to Puerto Rico. Now, obviously, it's a little hard to follow the president at the best of times, but beyond rhetoric, you know, I mean, isn't there a sort of competition now, a compassion fatigue competition? You've got the repairs from Harvey in Texas and repairs from Irma in Florida, and now you've got Puerto Rico. So where would you put Puerto Rico in the queue there?
So Florida and Texas have two senators each and a whole lot of representatives each. Puerto Rico has no representation in Congress other than an ineffective resident commissioner who has no voice or vote in Congress other than some committee participation. So part of the challenge is that Puerto Rico doesn't have the same political pull in Congress. And second, because Puerto Rico is on the Financial Control Board created by Congress, there might be an opportunity if the Financial Control Board manages to persuade Congress, but it's not clear that Congress is compassionate enough or has the same level of compassion. And the Supreme Court authorizes Congress to discriminate against Puerto Rico on financial matters.
Explain that. That seems extraordinary.
So when Puerto Rico was acquired in 1898, the military and Congress invented a new territorial status in order, known as the unincorporated territory, in order to protect Congress from being bound by past territorial precedents. And the first thing that the legislation did is they decided to treat Puerto Rico as a foreign territory in a domestic or constitutional sense. And the Supreme Court affirmed that. Since then, all the way up to last summer, Congress has the power to enact discriminatory legislation when it comes to federal funds or federal aid. Congress is not bound to treat Puerto Rico or extend parity to U.S. citizens living in Puerto Rico because Puerto Rico is considered to be a foreign territory in a domestic or constitutional sense. So legally speaking, constitutionally speaking, as late as last summer, 2016, the United States Congress has the legal authority to enact legislation that can discriminate, that can extend some funding or withhold funding from Puerto Rico. So in other words, right now, any funding that goes to Puerto Rico is really up to Congress and the goodwill of Republicans.
Well, they haven't been exhibiting a lot of goodwill lately, this latest healthcare bill that they're trying to push through. Is cruel and unusual punishment, even though...
And that's the problem in Puerto Rico, that we can't expect much from this Congress, even though the president is making all these rhetorical statements.
So what will it take then, Charles? What will it take?
For a different Congress, is my guess. Or somehow a way to find some sort of strategic benefit for helping Puerto Rico. Because with PROMESA, even though Congress assumes some responsibility to govern, to manage the fiscal crisis in Puerto Rico, it also assumes, or it also states, bound or required to address all the shortcomings of Puerto Rico. So part of it is going to depend on whether the Financial Control Board is going to demand and whether Congress is going to work with the Financial Control Board. But the measures that the Financial Control Board have been taking are based on austerity. So we don't, you know, unless Puerto Rico somehow can influence the commercial standing of the United States or has some sort of impact, it's not clear that Congress is going to make an investment, a multi-billion-dollar investment, to fix the grid in Puerto Rico. It might open it for a bid.
Well, there's some talk of privatizing. I mean, apparently the person that has oversight over in the Congress is Representative Rob Bishop, a Republican of Utah, who's tied in with the energy sector. What's your sense, just in closing, about whether there's going to be some kind of privatized deal? I don't know who's going to pay for that. I mean, in terms of ratepayers, they're obviously not, they don't have electricity now, and it's going to take a month or so, apparently. So you're starting with a pretty low baseline in terms of income in Puerto Rico to begin with, aren't you?
Yeah, I think this is an opportunity for advocates of privatization to push for the creation of a private grid. And this has been in the working. This is just an opportunity that enables Rob Bishop and some conservative elites in Puerto Rico who've been wanting to privatize the grid, and also to push for alternative sources of energy, like the gas viaduct. I think this is what's likely to happen, and they might get some subsidies from Congress, but Puerto Ricans will end up paying really high rates, electric rates, per kilowatt hour. But yeah, I think that's my suspicion, that we're going to see more privatization, and even the construction of private grids.
Right. Well, in other words, this Republican Congress would be happy to give money to subsidize a energy company, but not take care of the Puerto Rican people.
Or U.S. citizens of Puerto Rico.
Right. So that seems to be the way it's likely to happen. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Charles Venator Santiago.
Anytime.
Appreciate it. And again, I'll be speaking with Charles Venator Santiago, who's a professor of Latino politics, public law, and political theory, who holds a joint appointment with the Department of Political Science and the Institute of Puerto Rican and Latin American Studies at the University of Connecticut.
We're going to take a brief station break and back look into whether Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager, was a Kremlin asset and an important part of an overall Russian intelligence operation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who's a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. A member of the Russian Academy of Natural Sciences, he worked as a Swedish diplomat in Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia and Ukraine. And his latest book is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Well, thank you, Anderson. You and I have spoken over the months and years about trying to figure out what's happening in Russia and Ukraine. And the more that one tries to figure out this whole Russian influence campaign or the active measures campaign that the special counsel is looking into, the press keep uncovering stuff in dribs and drabs, and it sort of drips in from all different directions, leaving you with this impression that this is a multifaceted operation. And the only way to understand it, as far as I can tell, is to see it as an intelligence operation. In other words, the people who orchestrated it, if that's indeed what happened, are the ones that really know the full scope of it. And we're just sort of chipping away the edges, gradually moving towards the center. Is that a way to look at this?
Yeah, I think so. Of course, what we see is that there are very many high-level contacts in the Trump campaign with very dubious Russians. And I hear from various sides that there's much more to come from people who are not suspect as yet. So this will involve a lot of money, intelligence, and high-tech.
Well, let's start with the money. It looks more and more as though Paul Manafort was either a Russian asset. We certainly know he was a Ukrainian asset in terms of Yanukovych, the pro-Russian leader who was deposed. He was on his payroll and well compensated. But his longtime assistant, Konstantin Khmelnik, apparently he's a former GRU military intelligence officer, and the most recent revelations we've gotten from the New York Times indicate that just 2 weeks before Donald Trump accepted the Republican presidential nomination, Manafort offered to provide private briefings on the race to this Russian billionaire that's closely aligned to with the Kremlin, Oleg Deripaska, otherwise known as the Aluminum King. So, and he has close relations with Putin, apparently. Is there a kind of chain of influence there? In other words, if Yanukovych was Putin's guy and Putin was essentially orchestrating that regime, and of course he broke with Ukraine and started the war and seized Crimea once Yanukovych was deposed by the Ukrainian people, it seems as though it's sort of pretty obvious, isn't it, that the guy Manafort could well have been just greedy and a useful idiot, as the KGB used to refer to Western dupes. But how do you see him?
Manafort, I know him reasonably well from work in Ukraine. And Paul Manafort is possibly the best political advisor in terms of winning elections that there is in the world. And he has one strong objective, money. I think that he was very loyal to Yanukovych. And he won four elections, three parliamentary elections and one presidential election for Yanukovych. So when my Ukrainian friends heard that Manafort would be the campaign manager for Trump, they said the election is done. Trump will win. They had seen him in action. But there are several things in this. One is, you alluded to it, what was said at the time was that Manafort did $9 or $10 million a year. We have seen that he made $17 million for 2 years, but for the other years we haven't seen the money. He was working for all the campaigns. He was extremely effective. Ukrainian election campaign under Yanukovych cost about $1 billion. So to spend $9 or $10 million a year on the outstanding Manafort was certainly worth it for Yanukovych, but this was corrupt money. What Paul has taken here would be money laundering. What he has not taken here would be tax evasion. So this is the purely economic side of it. But then you have a big question. Manafort works for money, only for money. And here he was campaign manager for Trump for 5 months. The big question I have, who paid him? Certainly Manafort was paid. And this could lead straight to Russia, or it could lead to some Russian intermediary who provided him with money on an offshore account. This is what I would really want to have investigated. And then an additional aspect is that Manafort, while winning all these elections for Yanukovych in Ukraine, manipulated the Russian media, that is, that they run from Moscow, in their coverage of Yanukovych. So he has eminent contacts with Russian media, and Russian media and intelligence are very closely connected. And why wouldn't he use that in the election here in the U.S.? So I think that the new picture that the Mueller investigation brings out of Manafort as the real spider in the web is very likely. And he's highly intelligent. I find him very pleasant, extremely well-informed, unassuming, but he takes command when he needs to take command. So probably this is the most skillful person in the Trump circle.
Well, that's, you've answered the very question I wanted to get to, which is who paid him. We know that Yanukovych was, for all intents and purposes, Putin's puppet, if not his preferred candidate. And if Putin decided to go to war and seize Crimea once Yanukovych was toppled, it would indicate that this was an important chink in Putin's armor. And you've got the possibility of these Russian oligarchs being conduits, if not for Kremlin cash, certainly as cutouts for the Kremlin. But my understanding is that not only was a FISA warrant issued to roust Manafort out of his bed at 4 a.m. At his home in Virginia, after the lock was picked, he was also under FBI surveillance up until quite recently. And prior to that, in 2014, was under CIA surveillance, I assume, in Ukraine itself.
Yeah, I find this perfectly normal. He has been working for Yanukovych, who was dead against Ukraine, getting closer to NATO, getting a membership action plan for NATO. And this was clearly done at the advice of Manafort. Yanukovych hardly did anything in any policy without taking Manafort's advice. Manafort was in favor of association agreement with the European Union. He was in favor of accession to the World Trade Organization, but he was dead against any closer cooperation with NATO. And this is, of course, against U.S. Interest and in favor of Russian or Yanukovych interest. And you mentioned this Konstantin Kilimnik, who was sacked from the International Republican Institute in Moscow in 2004 or 2005. And immediately after he was sacked from IRI's office in Moscow for this reason, Manafort hired him. So what does that mean, that he hires a known Russian military intelligence person? And Kilimnik was seen in Kiev as the right-hand man of Manafort. Manafort, in spite of all his skills, does not speak a word of Russian or Ukrainian. So he used Kilimnik in all his conversations with Yanukovych, who only speaks Russian and Ukrainian, as interpreter. So Kilimnik was the key person for Manafort and widely considered the smarter than the Americans that Manafort had working for him. So Kilimnik is a key person, and he was here at least twice, that is in Washington, when Manafort was campaign manager for Trump. And then you wonder, what would CIA and FBI do if they don't keep the eye on a Russian military intelligence person who works for a very senior American? And Kilimnik was at the Republican convention in Cleveland. So I was just astounded that this did not cause more noise at the time.
And we know what happened, surely. Anders, don't we know what happened at the convention? At the platform committee, the only thing that the Trump people asked for in terms of the Republican platform being altered in any way, the only thing they wanted to remove was the idea of sanctions against Ukraine.
Yeah. So for me, as an expert on Russia and Ukraine, it was completely obvious from the beginning that this is a big intelligence operation with Manafort in center, WikiLeaks in a major role, and then Russian high-tech in unclear fashion. And people thought that it was not collusion and intervention in the election. So for me, it's only a matter of formality to find the evidence so that it stands in a court. The case is pretty clear, and then it's the question who was involved. We have this fact. The Jared Kushner is deeply involved with Roman Abramovich and Lebedev. Both are very close to Putin, in particular Roman Abramovich, and Kushner met the head of Neshekonom Bank, who's a senior KGB officer, and Neshekonom Bank is formally a non-governmental organization. It's not formally a bank. It functions as a Putin slush fund. This is a person that nobody in Kushner's position should ever meet, and certainly not one-on-one, because both that he's an intelligence officer and that he is the head of the Putin slush fund. And on like this it goes. So you can hardly see any contacts that are not dubious that these people have with Russia.
So what are we to make of reports from Moscow that there's something of buyer's remorse going on with Putin? He's so much worse off now than he was before in terms of sanctions and the Congress basically stepping in. And my understanding is that Putin was warned by Ivanov, his former chief of staff, who apparently was a much more senior and seasoned and more internationally experienced KGB officer. He was a general. And as we know, Putin himself was a minor apparatchik in the KGB in Leipzig. The more talented KGB people were sent to...
In Dresden.
Pardon? Yep. Yeah, Dresden, sorry. And but the more intelligent ones were sent to, London, Bonn, Washington, New York, etc. So is it, given that so many of these characters that have shown up who are ex-intelligence people are actually out of the GRU, like Kilimnik, who's Manafort's right-hand man, and the GRU apparently was behind the Podesta hack and the DNC hack. Is it possible that when people like Ivanov and others warned Putin that this intelligence operation against this active measure operation against the U.S. was reckless and would have blowback, he was fired? And did Putin then turn to the GRU? I mean, it just seems somewhat obvious that that the sort of zealots and the Young Turks were able to win Putin over, and the more seasoned ones were marginalized.
Well, we can see from this Christopher Steele dossier, one of the most interesting parts of it is a daily report from Sechin, the head of Rosneft, also seen a military intelligence person, and Sergei Ivanov, daily reports from meetings with them, what was going on in the Kremlin. And these were during the days that Sergei Ivanov was sacked in August 2016. So something was going on there. As you suggest, and exactly how, it's difficult to see. And clearly, Sergei Ivanov is a much more, should I say, calmer, and I know him reasonably well because he speaks Swedish, and he normally comes up to me at official receptions to speak Swedish with me. He's quite fun, actually. But and he's also this kind of person who's not afraid of talking to foreigners, and is quite open in his contacts, while Putin is very targeted and withdrawn. He only goes for what he absolutely wants to do. He's not going out and entertaining himself as Sergei Ivanov does. Putin does encourage hard competition between the intelligence agents. As you noticed, it was both the FSB, the domestic intelligence agency, and GRU, the military intelligence agency, who hacked the Democratic National Committee. Who did not hack it was the foreign intelligence agency that you would expect to do such things. And asking well-informed people why did two different intelligence agencies hack the Democratic National Committee, the best explanation I hear is that they didn't know what the others were doing because they're operating so independently of one another. And Putin now seems to rely much more on the FSB and on GRU, but their functions are normally different. FSB is much more about intelligence information. GRU is the organization that carries out the so-called wet actions, the assassinations.
So that's the distinction between Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, right?
Yeah.
GRU and FSB, but the SVR stayed out of it. So what's the when do you think this picture is going to emerge? Because as I say, it's the only way I can make sense of it, is the people who really know what happened are in the Kremlin. They're not in the special counsel's office, and he's trying to put the pieces together, is he not? And
in fact, what I hear underhand here in Washington is that an enormous amount of knowledge is available, but it has to be reasonably verified. So I do think that the special counsel, Robert Mueller, has all of the information that he needs, and he will, for example, have the tax returns of Donald Trump. That will say a lot. He is able to demand information from Deutsche Bank, whether there is a Russian guarantee for the big loans to the Trump organization and to Jared Kushner, as is widely rumored. I think that most of these things are available to Robert Mueller. And then we're coming back to the point you made that Putin has really overplayed his hand. He has shown how massively Russia does all these things. So I have good hope for this leading to splendid reforms when it comes to transparency in Washington and to a much clearer understanding of what, for example, Facebook and Twitter are allowed to do, so that they cannot be taken in by foreign intelligence agencies, as they seem to have been the case.
And of course, this is not entirely a Republican disaster. It's bipartisan in terms of money running Washington, because the other person that Yanukovych hired along with Paul Manafort was Tad Devine, who ended up running Bernie Sanders' campaign. So just in closing, though, Anders Aslan, do you think that it's clear that the special counsel is putting a lot of pressure on Manafort and has told him he'll be indicted, and the raid was unusual. It was almost a black bag job, and obviously had to get a FISA warrant to do it. So do you think that that kind of squeezing Manafort will work out? Do you think putting pressure on him, he'll squeal and name others above him who presumably would be Trump himself?
Well, I think that sooner or later some of them will. We also have Carter Page, who seems to have been involved in a very strange business with Rosneft shares, possibly for Trump. We have General Michael Flynn. I think that these are the three prime candidates. But we have also then a lot of smaller people around Manafort. I think that if not Manafort, I think that his collaborators, of whom there are many around, that they will start talking.
Well, Anders Aslan, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, a professor at the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University, a former Swedish diplomat in Moscow. His latest book is Ukraine, What Went Wrong and How to Fix It. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again on Sunday with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.